Hello and welcome back to season four of the Mic'd Up Show, where every mortgage has a story. And the Mic'd Up Show is the ultimate hub where hidden stories behind the mortgage industry come to life. My name is Michael Kelleher. And together we dive deep into the entrepreneurial spirit, the strategic insights, the breakthrough innovations that build the world's greatest mortgage companies. Typically, you would find these at different conferences across the country, including the one our guest today, Stephen A. Milner, just came from in San Diego. Our show is for you in the mortgage industry that maybe doesn't have the financial access. Maybe your lender owners or bosses have not sent you nationally yet, maybe because you're so talented, they're worried you might not come back. But for whatever reason, we give you access to these giants of the industry to show you that they are very accessible and they do want to lift all ships with the tide. So whether you're advancing your career or you're scouting for industry leaders to work alongside or exploring opportunities in fintech and prop tech and how it can come into mortgage, you're in the right place. So get ready to unlock the story behind every mortgage. Let's dive in today with Stephen A. Milner. I have seen him throughout the years. I've been going to conferences since 2013, and you can always recognize him by his suit and his tie. And it's more recognizable these days where they even go as far as saying it's business casual at this conference. And I remember even right before or right after COVID, I went to an IMB where I had the suit and tie on. Probably for different reasons, trying to make up for an image early on. And now I wear it because my wife is shocked if I go to a conference and I'm not wearing a tie. She doesn't get it. So I do put it on. And I was getting harassed in the elevator in a good way, busted, you know. And, you know, it's business casual, they were saying. And I said, I know, I wear it. And then Stephen A. Milner got on the elevator. No one said anything to him because he has been really a decorated person in this industry. He started as a loan officer in 1981, so he can speak not just being on the front lines as a loan officer, but as he started his company in February of 1994 as a CEO that oversees day-to-day operations of one of the largest IMBs in the country and certainly in New York, he has maintained keeping his license as a licensed mortgage originator in 50 states plus Washington, D.C. And as we've become more and more regulated, it's become more and more difficult. So if I take you back to that February day where you went from a loan officer to starting your own company, are you any different then than you are now? Like, what was that first day walking into your first branch or building that you actually were going to be running?
Well, first of all, thank you, Michael. For the introduction, and Michael Zhao, great to see you, sir. Looking good. Just as a brief background, as many of you know, I was a school teacher for 18 years. And in 1980, I started originating loans at 21%. That was the average loan rate during the Reagan and Bush administration. And I left teaching in 86. And I got involved with a mortgage brokerage company from 86 to 94 in Bayside, Queens. And I had two other partners there, and they wanted to stay a mortgage broker. I had visions of becoming a mortgage banker. So we amicably parted ways at the end of 1993. And on February 17th, 1994, I opened up US Mortgage as it is today. And I've always thought my goal was always to become a licensed mortgage banker. And it took about 2 years with, at that time, it was just the New York State Department of Banking, the banking department. And it took me about 2 years. As you know, many companies are still not licensed in New York because it's just very difficult for some reason. But I think I was one of the first mortgage brokers that got approved as a banker. And that was my goal and aspiration, to become a lender. And it was very exciting. You know, I started the company by myself. I capitalized it myself. No partners, no investors, no stockholders, just me. And we opened up an office on Long Island. And I continued to grow the business, originating loans, recruiting salespeople, building out the infrastructure. I stayed away from the subprime era the late 90s, early 2000s under the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration. I stayed away from those loans. I've always said one of my Milnerisms, as I call it, if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make dollars. So I just didn't understand those loans. And I've always felt that a borrower must be able to demonstrate the ability to repay the loan and the willingness to repay the loan. And that philosophy is probably what has kept me in business for going on, what, a little over 31 years now. And as you mentioned before, Michael, during the Great Recession, the Financial Reform Act was passed. Part of that was the creation of the SAFE Act, which required loan officers to become licensed. So I wanted to expand throughout the country. At that time, we were only licensed in New York and New Jersey as a banker, and I felt I wanted to expand my footprint throughout the country. And then as I said, the SAFE Act was passed requiring loan officers to become licensed. So I volunteered myself to be the QI, the qualified individual, to become licensed as a loan officer. So it took me about 2 years. I traveled at that time, you had to travel to a testing center in the state that you wish to get licensed in. So I traveled from Hawaii to Alaska to Maine to every testing center. It took me about 2 years, but I got it done by 2010. And that enabled U.S. Mortgage, thusly, to become licensed in every state. So by 2010, we were licensed in every state, including Washington, D.C., which is, so we have 51 licenses. And I spend 39 hours, 8 hours for the CE, and then another additional 31 hours every year doing my continuing ed. I still originate 8 to 10 loans a month with my assistant, Julie Curto, who's been with me about 27 years now. She's licensed in 48 states. I think it's very important for a CEO to originate. I believe in doing that. It really keeps me in touch with the challenges and frustrations that loan officers are going through at the kitchen table, so to speak. And I really enjoy that part. It keeps me in touch with marketing initiatives, lead generation initiatives, as well as product. There's so many different types of products available now, more so than they were ever before. But so that's sort of an overview of where I've been and where I am now, where I'm going, but continue to expand throughout the country. So, and I really appreciate this discussion. So thank you so much. I hope I answered your question. So
that's amazing, Stephen, because you know, you're coming into the mortgage industry just out of the savings and loan debacle, fall of Continental Illinois, and then the Reform Act. And then you go from that into the Russian bond crisis of 98. And then you go straight into whatever was going on in the early 2000s. And then we go through the pandemic and so on and so forth. Not only is there a lot of emotions going through that, but one of the things I find striking in what you have accomplished during this time of origination is that you're taking a no-nonsense, very make-sense approach to your origination platform. You didn't like subprime mortgages that much. I'm not sure how you feel about non-QM. We'll get to that shortly. How do you lead by example in your practice as an originator to go do 5-10 loans with your assistant and then transfer that into telling your other branches and originators to also follow that example when most originators are talking to themselves to say, let's just do everything that we can. You've lived through all these experiences doing make sense lending. What do you tell your originators to say, just make it make sense?
Great question, Michael. Well, one of my major skills, and I think my highest and best use as it comes to origination, is that I consider myself an expert in lead acquisition. As you know, we're a distributed retail, self-sourced, self-generated business model. We do about 93% purchase money all over the country. And that's how I built my business. And I love mentoring. I love teaching. To this day, I still focus on educating and working with my salespeople. I travel all over the country to all our different branches, and I'll be the first to volunteer to do a lunch and learn or a networking event. I'm very focused on strategic planning and goal setting, and I will provide private tutorials to any loan officer who really wants to grow their business. My philosophy here at U.S. Mortgage has always been that we're giving people an opportunity to build a business within a business at no cost. And that is our model here. And I love mentoring. I love teaching. I'm great at marketing and I'm great at lead acquisition. It just happens to be probably my highest and best use as a leader because I live it. I go through it and I can help a loan officer become very successful within a short period of time. And I've done that with many, many, many loan officers. And, you know, as I always say, no one woke up one day and they said they wanted to be a loan officer, right? No one I know. And I know a lot of people in this business and it becomes an evolution and it's a great opportunity to build a business. And that's what I just happen to be good at, marketing and lead acquisition, the various techniques that I use that I've been using since 1980, that to this day, I still use them and I promote them and I teach them and I mentor them. And I think it works pretty well. So.
Yeah, I think you have an amazing trait of, there's a famous Instagram out there where someone says to really unlock wealth, you need to learn how to work on yourself and not just work on your business. And it's starting to unlock for me coming to life. I began writing on LinkedIn and it wasn't for the vanity metrics that most people think in marketing. It was the type of people that all of a sudden were direct messaging me that could relate to writing better than video the whole time. And I never knew that because I didn't take the time to work on myself in that area. I think loan officers that come in and work with somebody like yourself, you've really mastered having a brand, an aura to yourself that must lead to lead generation of being somebody they can trust and have a feeling that they know exactly what that person needs for a mortgage.
I can just add one other point. Sorry, Michael. One of the things I stress to all my loan officers is that they must adopt what I call a giver's gain mentality. They have to be able to ascertain first what they can give to their referral sources before they try to gain. Most loan officers have their hands out and they want to try to gain immediately. That has never been my methodology. My methodology has always been to try to explore what the business model is of a particular referral source, such as a realtor or an attorney or an accountant. Get to know them, get to ascertain what their business model is and what you can do as a loan officer to increase their business. And by doing that, you're going to be giving first and then gaining just becomes a natural occurrence. So I meant to mention that before, but the giver's gain philosophy is something that most loan officers do not do. Their hands are out for business because they have the best rates, the best products. You have to think differently. You have to help people improve their business. Give first and then you will gain. Sorry, Michael, but I just wanted to interject that.
Well, sometimes you need to see it to believe it works. And we had Dave Licken as a guest last week and he talked about her at Southwest Airlines. And what separated him was he would go down and take the bags and throw them in and see what, because that's really where the pain points were for his customers. It was in those luggage drop-offs, not up in the air oftentimes. So when you said you originate, that's what sticks out to me. I also point out I was at a conference recently and I ran into Stephen and Jim Bopp and we were eating and I told them about my new daughter and Elise Keller for the family. And he took down my address and sent me this book, The New First 3 Years of Life. And what his message to me was a stat about how much of an IQ is produced and how important every minute is at this point in her life. And it'll tell you pieces, for example, that a baby, it takes 18 months for a baby to really remember an object. So whether you take it away or not, it's not going short-term memory. You just want to replace it. It gives you all these ways to make the mind bigger, the mat bigger, so it can absorb more. Reason I say all that is it wasn't just for me. I find out he has a whole office full of these. And so when he finds first-time home buyers or any buyer that's building up because of one of the 7 D's, dependents, has a new baby, gives it to them. So that's an example where you're not just at a high level giving it to me. You're able to show a story where you're still on the front lines and you get what people tick because every mortgage has a story.
Listen to this podcast, would like a book, please send me your information and I'll gladly send you one. And just to expand on what Michael was just saying, a child attains 50% 50% of their adult IQ by the time they're five. 50%. So by the time from five and through adulthood, they only gain another 50%. So this book really is very detailed. It's intense. It's like 370 pages, I believe it is. And there's different ways as a parent. Yes, First 3 Years by Burton L. White. It really identifies some of the things that you can do as a parent to help increase your child's IQ. It's a very good book, but it does take time, effort, and energy to read it. Let's face it, you know, but there's things that you can do. And if anyone would like a copy, I'd be glad to send you one.
That reminds me of the saying, I think it was Zig Ziglar or Jim Rohn that said, if you help enough people get what they want, you will get eventually what you want. What are some examples of some of the questions that you might ask somebody else to glean from them what it is that they want? Because, I mean, we don't actually, a lot of people, what I have found out in me talking, when I ask them questions, they actually don't know what they want until you actually get very granular with them. So they find out what's important to them. Would you be able to share with us some of these questions that you might ask?
So my methodology in answering your question is as follows, which I've been using for 45 years since I started in the business. My goal was to try to ascertain how, as I said before, how I can help some, how I can give to someone before I gained. So my methodology is as follows. I sit down with the person. I basically ask them, I basically describe to them, or basically state to them, I should say, that I have different ways in which I can help increase your business. My goal of which is to sit down with them, cup of coffee, lunch, breakfast, dinner, whatever it is. At that meeting, gentlemen, what I will do is I will start that meeting simply by saying that I'd like to get to know where you have been in your business and personal life, where you are now in your business and personal life, and where are you going primarily in your business career? And I want to hear what their story is. And then I tell them, before you tell me your story, I will share with you my story. And I then describe to the person where I have been, where I am now, and where I am going. And by doing it that way, I have found that the person that I'm speaking to feels comfortable about telling me their story. So I will tell my story first, and then they will tell me their story. And I'm taking notes. If they're in my office, by the time I'm done with their story, I'll have 3 to 5 pages of notes from the time they were born, what high school they went to, what college, what degree did they have, what was their career, their personal relationships, their children, the whole story. I'll get to know everything about them. My goal, Michael, is to explore where they are going. They can easily tell me, and it doesn't have to be rehearsed. We all have a story. We all have an evolution, right? So they'll tell me eventually where they have been, where they are now, and I'm focusing on where are they going. And I want to be able to walk out of that meeting thinking of a way where I can give to help them increase their business. And it's a very structured kind of discussion. Again, I tell my story first, and that creates an opportunity for the person to feel comfortable. Instead of asking the person first to tell me their story, I'm going to open up about my entire story, you know, from the time I was born in LA, Los Angeles, all the way through the time I decided to become a law officer, and my entire story. And I tell everything. I open up my entire life to everyone. That causes a level of comfort. And again, my goal is to walk out of that meeting thinking of a way that I can really understand what their business model is and what I can do to help them. And it's worked for me for 45 years. But my recommendation is, it's a very structured approach, but the whole idea is to know where is this person going with their career, whether it's an accountant or a realtor or an attorney or an insurance broker, a financial advisor. What can you do to help them? At the end of the day, you have to be able to help someone.
Can you share the story of that first person you put in a home? Do you still remember who it was or what mortgage and home was behind that story?
Well, it's funny. When I first started, I started originating loans because I was a school teacher and wasn't making much money. I started in June of 1980, and the company I was working for had a training program, but they did not offer the training program to part-time loan officers. I wasn't about to give up my career as a school teacher. I had to feed my family, right? So I started to learn the business myself. What he did was he gave me his copy of the Fannie Mae and the Freddie Mac seller servicer guides, which were about 4 inches thick. There was no technology in those days. I read them in 1 week. I came back. I started originating loans. But because I did not receive any training, my first 24 loans that I originated never closed. I made $0. But I've always believed in life and our personal and our business life that persistence can overcome resistance. And that was by June of 81. And then I went to another mortgage company about an hour and a half away from where I lived. And I started to learn the business. I was still teaching. And I'll never forget this. In 1981, I got a referral from a realtor for someone who bought a house for about, it's amazing. It's interesting how you asked that question, for like $125,000 at the time. The loan amount was about $98,000. The interest rate, you're sitting down, was 21%. During the Reagan administration and Bush administration, interest rates stayed as double digits through like 1991. If you ask your parents or your grandparents, they bought houses in the 80s, they paid double digits. But people still, during the 80s, they still, you know, wanted to fulfill the American dream of home ownership. They did not want to rent, and that's still the case today. You know, of course, you know, but people still pay 21%, 18%, 16%. But that was the first deal I closed at 21%. And the couple was thrilled. Later on, they refinanced and all that. But I'll never forget that. It was very exciting. Even at 21%, CDs at the time were paying 15%, believe it or not. Certificate of deposit paying 15. But I remember that. But
you know, I can resonate with persistence leading to resistance, because nowadays I would say that there's a lot of originators, even if they're doing 4 to 6 loans a month, the news travels and fast when it comes to, for example, like this past week, we had the news of Mr. Cooper being sold off, and you know, there's a whatever, or you know, 2-3 years ago, we have higher interest. There's always news that's causing origination turmoil at the retail level. And I think that when it comes to talking to originators out there, how does that extend to your originators? Because you're talking about new originations. However, with that type of news, you know, we can't help but think about how do servicing companies attempt to go and back solicit or this, that, and the other. How do you lead in CRM management, customer retention management, and aggressively market your past clients so that although you can be persistent with new business, you create resistancy and good service, also market your current database? How do you lead from that in customer referral and customer retention?
Well, we have a very extensive marketing department, to be quite frank. And in that marketing department, we have a CRM expert that we use, who helps our loan officers use the CRM. And we encourage that. They, you know, whether it's sending out birthday cards or closing anniversary cards, and they do that with the loans that we sell on, where we retain the servicing. For example, to Mr. Cooper, as an example, we sell a significant amount of business to Mr. Cooper over the years. And our loan officers are going to continue to maintain their relationships with those loans that we closed, that we did sell, in this case, to Mr. Cooper. And then now Rocket Mortgage is going to inherit that servicing portfolio, which I understand, but I'm very, you know, that's part of our marketing strategy, is to stay in communication, either through the use of a CRM regularly or just stay in communication with the customers that you close your loans for. There's a lot of different things that you can do, you know, but most common ones are anniversary cards, happy birthday cards, you know, and you should allocate And we encourage our loan officers to allocate at least one day a month to send out birthday cards to everybody in your closed loan pipeline. It works very well for us. I mean, that our loan officers depend on repeat business from the customers that they've established relationships with. But also for those that they haven't closed loans for that have been referred to them, we use the CRM for constant communication, and it works very well.
So good timing. So we're going to hear from our sponsors. One happens to be one of the up-and-coming CRMs around database, and the other, a title company, because that's typically the last thing you remember at the close, right, is the table.
Want to take your business to the next level? As a longtime trusted mortgage service provider, Mortgage Connect works with some of the largest lenders, servicers, and institutional investors, providing cutting-edge solutions for everything from title, closing, escrow, and default, to capital markets and risk solutions. Mortgage Connect brings it all to the table, redefining mortgage lending with innovative digital solutions that can elevate your bottom line.
It's time to use AI to revolutionize the way you do marketing in 2025. With ADM Intelligence, we have access to 5,000 consumer data points and proprietary AI technology that helps you understand who is in your database, what's the likelihood of people to do a real estate transaction, and also who they are. So for example, someone who's 50% likely to transact the next 6 months, who's a first-time homebuyer, should receive very different content than someone who is, let's say, not as likely to transact that already owns a home. And of course, our content team will provide you with all of that turnkey out of the box to market to everyone in your database. So to learn more, come find us at ICE. If you're there, we're booth number 327, or go to our website, thinkadium.com. Love to walk you through a custom demo of how AI can supercharge your marketing this year.
As someone who's the son of a gym teacher who found time while having us to manage a restaurant and go on and get her master's at Boston University and then eventually become a principal, I have an appreciation for the profession of teaching students as it gets harder and harder with these devices, right? But once you are one, you're always one, and you have that in your heart. Stephen, how do you take all those years of experience in the classroom and your exceptional preparation? How do you apply it to teaching those about homeownership before they move into their first home?
When I'm speaking to a client,
yeah, I was saying a customer, but if you want to apply it to maybe loan officers that join the first time, however you feel like it's the perfect way to use that superpower or experience that others may not have, does it still pop up even now?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea behind home ownership is to create, is to educate and teach people on the fact that home ownership is the key to building generational wealth. And that's been duplicated many, many times. And I think consumers understand that. To make light of it, sometimes I'll tell them if they're renting, I'll ask them a math question, which is simply, so if you're renting, Mr. Borrower, Mr. Potential Homeowner, what is your interest rate? And they will respond by saying, well, I don't, with a puzzled look on their face, they will say, well, I don't have an interest rate. I said, well, do you pay rent? Yes. Well, how much rent do you pay? Oh, $2,500 a month. I said, okay, you pay $2,500 a month to the landlord. That means your interest rate is 100%. And they look at me like a deer in the headlights. And I explain to them that their goal should be to create a path to a home ownership. And I tell them that one of our, as far as U.S. mortgage is concerned, our objective here has always been, our mission statement here is that is simply that everyone is entitled to a roof over their head. I also tell them at the same time that everyone is entitled to a roof over their head, but not everyone is entitled to a mortgage. And I think that was a mistake we made during the Great Recession and the financial crisis. But, and if they're not ready to purchase, then I will still pre-qualify them. I still promote pre-qualifying them. I still promote that the loan officers educate them on the home buying process and what's involved. And hopefully they become good students and you become an advisor to them, to the customer, as far as how to reach the goal of home ownership. And that's what the United States, not to be political, but we offer that more than any other country in the world, in my opinion.
Stephen, I love that you're a steward of education. And as part of that, not only are you educating your customers, like sometimes when I was originating retail a few years back, I would tell customers, I said, well, you know, if your house goes up by 3%, your rate of return actually goes up on the amount of down payment that you have. Your down payment valuation on the return is not 3%, it's 3% of the gross amount. And so they go, well, what do you mean? Well, if it, you know, if you put down $20,000, you know, and your house goes up by 3%, that's $3,000 on your $20,000. That's a 15% rate of return. And that type of education is invaluable, because not every person is an investor in practice and mindset. And in the same sense, when you talk to an originator, sometimes they are a great originator, but they're not a, I mean, you have a skill set beyond most, because you can be a business owner and an originator and understand both. To the originator that's out there in our listening audience that are originators, how do you speak to them if they are great originators, but not necessarily good, I'll say hopefully gently, maybe they're not great business people, but they're great originators. I'm sure you've met them before. What do you speak to them so you can give them the fiscal education to say, you know what, I know that you want to have your own P&L and run a team of branches, this and that, but based upon what I think I've seen of you, you should stay an originator, but I will make you a better originator and teach you how to do that. How do you speak to the originator so that they can exercise that type of wisdom to glean?
Well, when I sit with a loan officer when I'm mentoring or even teaching them, which I still do today, I develop what I call the 5 Milner Commandments of Loan Origination. The 5 Milner Commandments of Loan Origination, which are that a loan officer, a potential loan officer, or even a current loan officer, has to become a student of the following tasks. They have to know how to sell, how to qualify the borrower, how to take a full application, how to follow up with their pipeline, and how to market themselves. Those are the 5 Milner Commandments. You have to know how to sell, how to qualify, how to take an application, how to do pipeline follow-up, and how to market yourself. And I tell them straight up that there are times over the years, as you develop your business, you may be good at selling and marketing, but you're not a good tech, and maybe you don't develop the technical skills of qualifying the borrower, taking the application, or pipeline follow-up. Then there are those that I tell them that are great at the technical side, the qualifying, taking the app, and the follow-up. But they have what I call, what I refer to as call reluctance. They're not strong in selling and marketing. And I encourage them that at some point, as you develop your business, you're going to want to bring on at least a part-time loan officer after you identify what your weaknesses are, or loan officer assistant after you identify what your weaknesses are to fill in what you are not strong at. Maybe it's the technical side, or maybe it's the selling and the marketing side. And I tell them that will come over time. But at the very least, as you're developing your business, you should try to become an expert at those 5 Milner Commandments, as I call it. And they embrace that. They welcome that. They understand that. And I help them at each of those 5, with each of those 5 commandments. There's techniques for knowing how to sell to your borrowers and to your referral sources. There's reasons why you want to pre-qualify somebody and how to pre-qualify. There's reasons on why your applications should be complete applications, so that when an underwriter looks at that, it tells a story. It's like a novel. Pipeline follow-up, you need to know the status of your pipeline so you can communicate that to everyone that's directly or indirectly involved in that transaction. And then, of course, you have the marketing side. I always tell people that marketing is the key to building, expanding your lead acquisition processes. And that's how you accrue and accumulate new referral sources or existing referral sources through marketing. Marketing is the key and to growing your business. And you have to be able to do that. Now, if you have call reluctance because of that, well, then you have to fill that You have to fill that void. I always say, do not do something you could pay somebody to do. Whether it's cleaning your pool, mowing your lawn, identify your strengths and fill your weaknesses with someone else that could help you continue to grow your business. And that philosophy seems to work. And that's what I encourage them to do. Identify your weaknesses and then take it from there. And it does work. And I've been doing it for many, many years. And marketing is the key to growing the business. And I always say a business without a sign is a sign of no business. So they should be doing it.
Steven, when I see you in your suit and tie, I mean this respectfully, but it kind of reminds me of you're like Superman. You know, your suit is like a Superman suit. And the reason that I say that is because it's when you're putting on a suit, reminds me of kind of the older time to think of like Roland Arnell or Anthony Mazzello. And there's an old school representation of not only respecting yourself, but also respecting the business and the trade as well. And that's not only is that a part of your brand, it's also a part of who you are. And I think that brings a sense of confidence, not only to you as the brand, but also to the originator. It's something that's actually kind of a lost art at the moment. When speaking about your branding and marketing yourself, and especially in terms of call reluctance, I think the preparation of what you wear and then how you present yourself when you're getting ready, whether you make your bed, shave, put on your suit, and then you are ready for action. Is that something that you currently coach and help people on when they work for US Mortgage? And how does that recede by your teams so that they can put on their suit, whether it's a Superman suit of a suit and tie or what in their branding, maybe it's a t-shirt or a sweater. How do you convey that so that they can have that confidence? So the call reluctance not necessarily goes away, but it wanes as they practice more.
Well, interesting, Marvin, you bring that up because prior to COVID, I did have a dress code in the company for men and women. I always felt we're in banking. We don't sell pets. We're in banking. You should look professional, especially in the distributive retail business model. And I think that's why I try to set the example. I wear a suit every single day. I go to sleep like this, to be quite frank. But since COVID, to be quite frank, people they've changed their attitude about that. I shave every day. You know, I wear a suit every day. I try to set the example, you know, and as I said before, I'm the first to travel to my branches in Texas or California. And if we do an open house or I'll do an open house with a loan officer and I'll look professional. And I think it's important to look professional. We're in banking, you know, and I think I try to exude that philosophy and set that example. Some people accept like it, but some people have just since COVID just continue to wear a suit. Even when I go to conferences, most men are wearing suits and an open shirt. You know, I just personally don't agree with that, you know, and I will be at, you know, quite frankly, when I go to conferences, whether it's a mortgage bankers conference, because I'm very involved with the MBA, and I probably be one of two people or so that are in a suit and tie. I don't know. That's just the way that what's evolved over the last 5 years, you know, but I think it's important, you know, and I think that I try to stress that to loan officers, men and women, that you're in banking, you should look the part. I hope that answers your question, but that's...
Yeah. Is there anything that you speak to yourself, like do you motivate yourself or do you meditate? Maybe you pray to God, maybe you have something that you continue, a mantra that you speak to yourself. Do you have anything like that that you practice as a part of your routine?
Yeah, well,
the milk.
There's a there's a great book by William McGovern called "Make Your Bed," and my entire life I make my bed every morning, and it's amazing when you do that, and I highly recommend that. Not only in the morning, the impact of doing it in the morning is that you're walking around the bed, you're pulling down the fitted sheet, you're pulling down the cover sheet. Pulling down the covers. And what I have found over many, many years is that that's causing me to really think about, okay, where, what do I need to do today? That's one advantage. The other advantage is, as stated in the book, is that I don't think it's healthy to come home and your bed is not made. So I've always done that my entire life. And that really sets to be cognizant of what I have to do every day. It really helps me think about the kinds of things that I need to do. Because I'm actually, when you're walking around the bed, you're thinking about all that's about to happen and occur when you get to the office. So that's one of the routines I go through, you know. And I love this business. Some people live to work. Some people work to live. Working to live is budgetary in nature, which I understand. You have to feed your family. But I think in this business, especially for loan officers who are commissioned only, generally speaking, in the distributed retail market, they have to be able to get to the point where they live to work rather than work to live. Living to work is where you have a passion for what you do every day. And if you don't have that, if you do not have that passion, then that could be challenging. And that's what I tell people. You need to develop a passion for what you do. And I think people welcome that philosophy. And not only the loan officers, but many of my employees, many of them from whom have been with me 30 years, they just know that if you're going to come to work, then you have to have a passion. Otherwise, do something else.
And one way to re-energize that passion in this industry is an upcoming conference called the Advocacy Conference. One piece I commend about you, Stephen, is you show up. And obviously, showing up is not always the easiest to do it consistently year over year, decade over decade. But I think the younger generations just don't show up as much, whether it's in mortgage or your local meeting every Wednesday. There's different ways that they give back. But as this industry consolidates, there's less representation at the top at these advocacy conferences and other conferences. The advocacy is your why. If you plan on retiring or working the next decade in this industry, what does the industry mean to you? And this is where the industry goes and tells DC why we're important for homeowners to build generational wealth, not just some rocket app that clicks on subscriptions, right? The education you talked about. Can you just, talk about showing up for advocacy and what loan officers need to understand that they might have to pick up some slack in a consolidated industry to make sure we have enough numbers in the future at this conference specifically?
Well, Michael, I attend the I attend conferences about six, probably 18 a year. I'm very active with local statewide MBAs. I was chairman of the board last year for the Mortgage Collaborative. I'm very involved with the Mortgage Bankers Independent Executive Council. I'm on the council. My purpose in going, to be quite frank, is to leave those meetings, those conferences, with what I call nuggets of information. I'm always willing to learn, and I'm the first to say that I do not know what I do not know. And I go to the National Advocacy Conference because I want to become educated on what issues, as far as the NAC conference is concerned, could impact our business. And I do that on a state level as well, because I need to know what, because we're in every state, so I need to know what statewide issues could impact my loan officers in certain states, in every state. So I try to become a student. And that's why I go to these conferences. And I guess, and Michael, when we go next week, I'm sure one of the topics is going to be the HUD mortgagee letter that was issued last week regarding non-permanent resident aliens that FHA loans that will not be insured after May 25th. And I think it's important as a C-level individual in a mortgage company that you become a student of these issues. And I think because it could impact how you're running your business as a C-level employee. I've always said, and you know, education is very, very important, and you have to stay informed. I've always said an educated consumer is our best customer, and I like to feel educated so I can relate to my loan officers, who are my customers. My loan officers are my customers. They need to know what's going on in the industry. Today, we had a senior management meeting, and that was the main topic today about, okay, how are we going to handle the the impact of the non-permanent resident aliens. In our case, we do 11 to 12%. Michael, at the beginning of this meeting, you said that, I believe you said that there's another company that does 8 to 10%. I mean, that could be impactful.
And they thought it was just people, you know, the media makes it sound like it's people that maybe came over the border illegally, but it's not. It's so many different great employees here in America that have the W-2s that really qualify perfectly for a mortgage, a repay.
They have socials, they have W-2s. They're just not permanent residents. But listen, one of the main topics I'm going to be talking, now that you got me started on this topic, is that personally, I feel by the end of the summer, Fannie and Freddie are going to adopt the same restriction. So look out for that. And I think that's going to be one of the takeaways that I want to walk away from the conference. To what extent does the NBA feel that that's going to happen as well? And that could be impactful.
We all, just so people know, when we go down there, like the HUD is black and white, there's a lot of gray area that we're asking for guidance on. Yes. And so the gray area right now around Fannie is, it says you do not lend to people in this area that you think will not be residing there for at least 3 years. And now with everything you're hearing in the media, you have to start to wonder, can I consciously say that this person will be around in 3 years if they're trying to fight against that and maybe, you know, remove their citizenship? That's going to be a gray area until they actually announce something, and they might just stay in gray area. And so it's on Stephen and whoever, myself, we go down there and we just try to tell the politicians the adverse and also the ripple effect. It's never like the primary decision they make. It's the ancillary collateral damage that really hurts those. So that's, we all sit at our state tables, right, Stephen, and sort of do it unified together within our state. It's the easiest conference to go to because you actually have allies.
And I think, Michael, there are also going to be a lot of discussion about the privatization of Fannie and Freddie. They've been on the conservatorship, Dodd-Frank, I guess, you know, and
09-ish.
I think July of 2010, Dodd-Frank was implemented, and CFPB was created in January of 11 to oversee Dodd-Frank. But I think, so they've been in conservatorship since then, and they're making billions and billions of dollars. So at some point, I think there's going to be discussion at the National Advocacy Conference about the likelihood of the GSEs becoming private entities like they were before, right? And what is the time frame for that? And if that occurs, then what would be the ramifications to independent mortgage bankers or the entire origination business model? Personally, I think that they're going to raise their guaranteed rate fees, the guaranteed fees, I should say, the G fees, as they're called, and that could impact interest rates. But we'll see how that goes. But I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion about that. I'm sure that's on the list of the president wants to do in terms of saving money, I would think. I could be wrong, but
I think you're right. I think us as an industry go down there to make sure, at least if it happens, it's fair on the other side. And it's not made the biggest lobbying purse win. And then we have to collectively almost agree on that together. I will let Mike do the final sign off, but I did want to make one quick point, Stephen, in the form of a rhetorical question or an actual question for comment. But I do think as we talk about generational wealth, and we will go down there and talk about generational wealth, the fact that you had a path and even said, go on a journey, son, before you come back. But the fact that your mortgage company represents a generational pass down where your customers that you've told years ago, you're going to look out for them for their generational wealth. You have a family plan to make sure that your next in line is going to help out their next in line. I think that's really cool. And hopefully we get to hear more stories about that by our guests on the show and more people promote doing that. So I'm sure you enjoy working with your son day to day. I know you do.
I'll just interject because you brought that up, that I do believe that a company should have a built-in succession plan. Many of the companies that have entered into M&A activities since the last 5 years did not have a built-in succession plan. And that's caused a great deal of discontent during any kind of sale or merger or acquisition, in my opinion. My story on that is really quick. When my son was born in 78, in 1996, he says, "Dad, you know," he was just accepted to Boston University at the time. He graduated high school, and he says, his name is Scott. And he says, "You know, Dad, it makes no sense for me to go to college. Why should I go to college and you spend all that money?" And he spent 4 years in college. I sat him down, I looked him in the eye, and I said, "Scott, two things are going to happen. Number one, you're going to go to college. I'm going to pay for it. Number two, you're not going to join my company until you can bring something to my company." I said to him, "Just because we share the same last name does not mean you're going to come into my company and possibly ruin what I work 18 hours a day for." And he did not understand, quite frankly, what I was talking about. And I went out to tell him that there's terrible stories you hear about children who enter their parents' company. They don't understand at an early age, you know, they don't understand the business. They don't understand how to deal with people. And very often the business fails. But most importantly, the relationship with their parents becomes very challenging. And it could lead to the ruination of a relationship. So he embraced what I said. He went to Boston University. He became a very successful investment banker on Wall Street. And then in 2010, when the company got licensed in every state, he decided to come on board because I felt that he could really bring value. Because at that point, I had to expand my senior management team, all of which are still with me today. And he's the president of the company. And I am, again, the founder and CEO. Again, no partners, no shareholders, no stockholders. We have distinct responsibilities. He's great on the IT side and on the economic side, you know, in terms of creating successful pro formas for potential candidates that we look to bring on. He's great with that. He's got a very high, what I call EQ, emotional quotient. You know, very calm, very easy to get along with. People really realize that. And I stress to people when I'm talking to them for the first time that if they're thinking about making a move, whether they come to me or another company, they should only go to a company that has a succession plan built in. To upset your whole life, your career, to find out a year or two later that the company is going to be sold because there is no succession plan, I think is a mistake. So we stress that. And he and I have a wonderful relationship. We get along. We have separate and distinct responsibilities. I'm very involved in the marketing and the education and the training. He's very involved on the IT side and the accounting. And we really have a great relationship. The only problem I have with Scott, to be quite frank, is that he cannot keep up with me, but he's still working on that.
Not to do that. I know he's not on, but I'm just saying.
If I could glean anything from our interview with you today, Stephen, I would say generational wealth is one of the themes and topics of our entire conversation. I think there is an attitude, generally speaking, that people think generational wealth only is on a fiscal or monetary level. However, generational wealth, from the way that you have proceeded to sell, from the way that you have led and are leading and are doing with your son currently at US Mortgage, has led us to believe that generational wealth just isn't about financial means. It is also about the way we do business, the personality and disposition of how we approach business, and then also how we can glean from that to lead that to another level, generation after generation, and then not with US Mortgage and your leadership of founding the company to your son and maybe to the next generation, whether it's by birthright or whether it's by M&A, there is a culture that Stephen Milliner has in generational wealth in his leadership. I love that you have commandments. I love that you have a sense of leadership of what you, of not just what, how to do things, but you are also doing those things that you practice in your origination, in your leadership, and as an executive at the C-suite level for US Mortgage. Stephen, thank you so much for coming and providing us with this, with your wisdom and leaning of leadership and style, because this interview just isn't about asking you your story. It's also about providing leadership through the Mortgage Collaborative and through the MBA, and how you are providing generational wealth, not only from a financial level, but also in leadership, so that the next generation of originators and C-suite owners of IMBs can also lead themselves into success as well.
I just want to close by saying that as a leader, when you're working with any employee, always remember that if the student has not learned, then the teacher has not taught, which means that you have to explore different ways to teach the content to your student, whether it be a loan officer or whether it be a non-commissioned employee. And sometimes people don't have the patience that is required. Not everyone is going to learn the content as you think they will. So, and that sometimes it's a struggle with our children, with our employees. The student has not learned and the teacher has not taught. That's my always been my philosophy.
Thank you for joining us on this journey into the heart of mortgage innovation. Remember, every mortgage has a story, and we're here to help you write yours. If you enjoyed today's insights, please subscribe, share with your network, and connect with us on social media. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries and uncovering the stories that drive our industry forward.